Okay, let's go ahead and get started. So we're going to continue the lecture from last week about linear regression, logistic regression. And where we left off was we were talking about the limits of the linear model in general. So we saw that there are examples of cases where a linear model cannot represent the boundary between the data of the two classes at all. And a very simple classical example of this was the exclusive OR data set that I have up there. And this one actually has a historical connection to neural networks that we'll talk about next week. So that's something, it's something I'll save for later. And what we discussed last time is even though even though it's not possible to find a line that separates the black points from the white points, if we augment the feature space, then we can make this relationship linear. For example, if I just look at the feature of x1 times x2, that's the only feature I need to look at to separate these four points. A more complex example of this is this one. So this is another example of how, just as we saw that using a nonlinear basis function in the linear regression case can let you represent a much more complex function, you can do the same kind of thing when you're doing classification, when you're doing logistic regression. So here's an example where the red points here are from one class. This is feature one and feature two. But whereas the blue points from the other class are a lot more dispersed. So if I want to try to classify this in the original feature space, this relationship isn't linear at all. So what I can do instead is I can augment this feature space with two Gaussian basis functions. So I don't have the equations for these on this slide, but they are the same as the RBF functions that we looked at during at the end of the linear regression lecture. So what these two basis functions are is, let me look at this. So so phi 1 is going to be basically the distance from this green point. That's going to be the first feature. The second feature is going to be the distance from this point. That's phi 2. So you can one way you could write this is you could say I'm going to make this a Gaussian. So I'll do e to the minus 1/2 the distance squared. And now if we plot this in this new transformed space, the decision is very clear. Even though I don't have a basis function up here, I can still classify these two points. Because if you see in the distance from the first point, I get one cloud of points up here. And then everything down here comes from, you see there's two clusters, one of which corresponds to this guy up here, and the other one corresponds to this guy up here. So by transforming into a different basis, we've made the classification problem much easier, because now there's a very simple linear separator between these two sets. That's one comment about logistic regression, that even though it's a linear classifier, it's linear means linear in the parameters. So by having a nonlinear basis, we can make it much more powerful. The second comment that I want to make about logistic regression was about a fast trick that I pulled on you when I was going over the likelihood for logistic regression. So if I go back to where I put this likelihood, it was back here. What I said was I want to maximize the probability of the data set given the parameters, and that's going to be my likelihood. So I said, oh, the data is going to be IID. Okay, that's fair enough. But then you notice the probability that I maximize, it's not the joint probability of X and Y. What I said is I'm going to maximize the conditional probability of the class label that I observed given the input. That's not what we did for naive Bayes. So for naive Bayes, we didn't go through the gradients or why it's maximum likelihood. But it turns out that naive Bayes can be seen as maximizing the joint probability. So it's got a likelihood, which is the product over I equals 1 through n, of the probability y equals yi comma xi given w. That's the likelihood you use for naive Bayes. So if we go go back to the future. So the naive Bayes classifier is called a generative classifier. The reason for that is that when we look at it as a probability model, we split it up into two parts. The first is a part that just depends on the class label, and the second is a probability distribution that tells me how to generate the data, the features, given the class label. So I start by building my model in the reverse direction that I care about, and then I use Bayes' rule. So that's the generative approach. Logistic regression is very different, because I just make up a functional form for P of y given x. I don't directly have anything that that just depends on y. So this is, and this is called a discriminative approach, because I'm focusing directly on this distribution of the class label that I care about. You notice I never had to use Bayes' rule when I was deriving the likelihood for logistic regression. So why would you do things one way versus another? So the main advantage that people cite intuitively for logistic regression is that when I have P of y given x, I don't worry about modeling the prior over P of x over the data. So remember, in naive Bayes, we had to make this kind of somewhat crazy assumption about the form of this distribution, that all of the little xj's are independent given y. Why would we want to make that assumption? They could interact in a very complex way, and we saw if they do, that does tend to screw up naive Bayes. So we saw an example where it couldn't model correlations. So why would we want to spend some of our, when we're trying to find the best parameters, why do we care about modeling correlations among the input? Because we'll always be given the input. So why would I need to learn a probability distribution over it? So that's the that's what people cite as an intuitive advantage of the discriminative approach, that you've made the problem harder by saying I want to model a joint distribution rather than just modeling a distribution over y. Now, there are advantages to the generative approach as well. So one advantage is it can be really good with missing data. So we saw that in naive Bayes, it was really easy to handle missing data. So if I was missing I was missing just one of the features from a particular instance, I could just ignore it, and that was fine. Whereas for logistic regression, you can't necessarily do that. So you don't have as good of a story in general for handling missing data in a discriminative setting. Another advantage to a generative approach, we're not going to really talk about this too much in the course, is it can be good for detecting outliers. So if I find a particular feature vector x that has really low probability under this P of x given y, maybe that's some kind of outlier that I could look at. Whereas in a discriminative setting, you don't have such a nice way of doing that. And the final advantage to a generative approach is sometimes I really do want to generate the input, right? Someone might want to say, given this class label, sample some interesting feature vectors and let me look at them. There are certain applications for which you really want to be able to do that. An example would be kind of the correction mechanism in your phone, right? If you want to correct typos, then you actually do want to be able to kind of sample x. And so the methods for doing that are typically generative. Now, all that having been said, naive Bayes and logistic regression are closer than you might think. And the reason is, we said logistic regression, that's a linear classifier. Well, it turns out, under a lot of situations, naive Bayes can be a linear classifier as well. Even though we presented it as being about these probability distributions, it turns out that if I take a naive Bayes model, so that gives me this, so a naive Bayes model, remember, will have a P of y, and then this P of x given y equals 1 and y equals 0. I turn that around using Bayes' rule to get this thing. And then if I look at the decision boundary, so for naive Bayes, that'll be the set of all points. The decision boundary between class 0 and class 1 will be the set of all points here where this probability of being in class 1 equals 0.5. Right? That'll be the decision boundary. Well, it turns out under a lot of situations, that decision boundary is linear. So one example is you can show if I have Gaussian naive Bayes. So what that means is, let's say, actually, we don't have to say that. So we'll say I have some real valued feature vector here. And given class 1, I'll assume I've got one mean and one covariance. So this x will be normal with some mean that for class 1. And for class 0, it'll also be normal, but with a different mean, but the same covariance between the two classes. So if I assume the distribution over x is normal, then I can go and compute this, use Bayes' rule, plug it in, and I'll actually find that my probability y equals 1 given x, I'll have a sigmoid function. And you can compute, just do some algebra, to compute what the weights are on this linear thing. But it'll be some function of the means and the covariance and the class priors. So in this situation, if I equal covariance, then I get a linear classifier again. If the covariance isn't equal, that doesn't hold anymore. It's nonlinear. If I let this covariance be different from this covariance, naive Bayes isn't linear anymore. Another example where you see naive Bayes gives you a linear classifier is if you have binary data. So if each of these xj's are 0, 1, and they'll have some probability under class 1 and some probability under class 0. And again, you do the Bayes rule thing to work out what the posterior of y equals 1 given x is, you'll get a sigmoid function. So naive Bayes is more like logistic regression than you might think. Now, the thing to keep in mind is, so if I run naive Bayes and I compute this, I'll get some w hat, which is the naive Bayes classifier. That's going to be different than the w hat that I get from logistic regression. So I'm not saying that logistic regression and naive Bayes are the same thing. They will pick different classifiers, but in these two cases, they'll pick different classifiers from the same class of classifiers. And I guess this was on a previous version of the slide. I'm not really sure what a keener is. I think that's something British. But if you are a keener or think that you might be, then you could try proving those two results. It's really just algebra and using Bayes' rule. The final extension to logistic regression that I want to talk about is how would you handle if there's more than one class? Because more than one class. That's a very easy classification problem. There's only one class. No, if you have more than two classes. So it turns out for logistic regression, that's actually very, very easy to handle. So what you do is, instead of just having one weight vector, you have one weight vector for each class. So if the classes are, say, one, if I denote each of the classes by k, then I'll call wk will be my weight vector for each class. And that's each of those wk's are going to have the same length as the feature vector x. And so then what I do to classify an element is basically I say each of these wk's gets a vote on whether it's the right class label or not. That vote is going to be proportional to the e raised to the power of wk dot product x. So that's going to be how strongly wk thinks it should have to claim x. And then my probability of actually being in class k is just going to be proportional to that vote. So I'll sum up the votes for all the classes and then divide by the sum so that I get a probability. And you can see, it's pretty easy to see that this is a probability. This has to be greater than 0 because it's an exp. And once I divide by this thing here, that means it has to be less than 1. And then if I add this up over all c, it cancels and I get 1. So this is a very natural generalization to what we've said so far with more than two classes. If I just had two classes, you can actually work it out, and it works out to be the same as what we presented for two-class logistic regression. So now what I do, once I've set this likelihood, I just do everything as we've said before, for the multi-class case as the binary case. That is, I take the log of this thing to be my likelihood, I compute the gradient, and then I maximize that using a numerical method that I haven't told you about yet. So that's multi-class classification. And the final question I wanted to ask is, why the heck are we doing anything in this lecture? Okay? Because you would think, why do I need logistic regression at all? Right? I already have linear regression. Maybe that's good enough. Why would I need a linear classifier with some kind of squashing thing on top of it? Maybe what I could do is, the class label is 0 and 1. Those are numbers, right? And linear regression, just regular linear regression, knows how to predict numbers. So why don't I just take, say, these blue points and these red points, and I'll use, you know, x1, x2 as my input to linear regression, and I'll use 0 and 1 as my output to linear regression, and then use that. So you know, it turns out that's not a good idea. There's a bunch of problems with that. Can anyone name one? Okay, I'll give you. Is it clear? Is it clear this straw man that I'm proposing about how to use linear regression here? Does that make sense? No. Okay, good. So here's what I'm saying. I'm saying don't use any of these classification methods that I've talked about, right? Because these classification methods are kind of adapted to this case where the classifier is only going to output a 0 or 1. I'll say maybe there's a simpler method that I could use to solve this classification problem. So I can throw away all these logistic regression, decision trees, whatever. Okay? Now here's what that method's going to be. I'm going to go back to this linear regression lecture. So what linear regression gave me is, given a data set of feature vectors and of real valued outputs, it comes up with some line that lets me predict between feature vectors and real values. Right? So it would be something like, if I had some, so if this is x1, and if these are my two features, x1 and x2, and I had some kind of continuous output, like maybe this one was 3, this one was 5, you know, this one was -3, and so on. If I had a continuous y that's attached to each one of these points, then what linear regression would do is it would learn this linear surface that given any new point, say maybe this one here, it'll predict the new y at that point. So given any set of, you know, given any set of input data and real numbers, I could run linear regression, and I get some kind of line out of it. So the question is, why can't I do that here? So for each of these blue points, I'll tell linear regression that the right answer is 0. For each of these red points, I'll tell linear regression that the right answer is 1. So those are both real numbers. Regression knows how to predict real numbers. So I could give that to my linear regression code and tell it, you know, what line do you come up with? And then given some new point, like here, I'll just ask it, you know, I'll just look up the value on that line, and that'll give me my class prediction. Nate, does that make, yeah? Yes.
There's a problem. For instance, if there is a group of red points in the right button.
Okay, so you're saying if I put red points over here.
A red button.
So where? Right. You mean like here?
In the right button.
Right. Bottom. Oh, here. Yeah, yeah. So if you put a red point there. OK, so if I put a red point down here, it's not going to classify this point, right? But logistic regression can't do that either, right? Because if I put a red point down here, then the two classes aren't linearly separable.
I mean, this red group is distributed in two areas.
Yeah, so I could put some red points like over here, for example, right? And so I could do that. And if I did that, linear regression wouldn't work for this. That's right. But logistic regression wouldn't work either. Because if I remember, logistic regression just has this decision boundary that's a line. If I put a bunch of red points here, then there's no line that separates blue from red. So OK, let's say I learned some kind of linear boundary, and it learned to give me numbers that were around 1 here and around 0 here. What kind of numbers would I get here? If I had some line, it would be some plane, some linear function that in this area gave me 1, in this area gave me 0. What is it going to do over here? Yeah, because it's going to be like negative 1 or something here, and like negative 5 here. So, you know, that doesn't make any sense. What does the class label of negative 5 mean? So that's one thing that that's going to do wrong. So if I take, so say I take some blue points, I put them right here. So now you've made it kind of very, very hard for a regression method, because you're saying over here is it's 0, over here it's 0. So now this plane that I'm putting above these two points is going to look straight. So it's going to be very hard to come up with some plane that sits on top of this that's going to say 0 here, 0 here, and 1 here. So it's going to have to sacrifice something. And it turns out in this example, what it's going to do is if I take these points and run linear regression, then I get a decision boundary, which is the set of all points for which I get 0.5 from this linear function. And it's right here, which is what you'd want. But now if I add some blue points over here, like, I mean, these points shouldn't make the problem hard, right? I mean, it's really, really easy that if all of these points are blue and I add a point here, I mean, that's got to be blue, right? But what it does is it tends to really distort the boundary that I get from linear regression. So the boundary that I get from linear regression changes from this to this just by adding these points. So that's one example of something kind of really bad that can happen. Whereas logistic regression still gives me these green points here. Because even once I train this boundary, adding these points, they're already so far into the blue class that they don't affect the likelihood very much. So basically, you know, what this means is, you know, there's a difference. You know, there's a reason we set things up this way. So even though, you know, it'd be nice if we could just run linear regression, that would be a much simpler algorithm. You know, classification is different than regression. That's really what this example is about. Okay, so that's basically everything that I have to say about logistic regression. It's the first linear classifier that we've seen that I've told you is a linear classifier, although it turns out that some that we've seen before are also linear. And we saw, and today we saw how this was a discriminative method as opposed to a generative method. So what I'm going to do next is I'm going to talk about these optimization algorithms that let us actually find that W that maximizes the likelihood. But before I do that, are there any questions about the logistic regression classifier? Mm-hmm. The feature of linear regression is that it's always going to predict using a line. So whatever W you give, it's going to give you WTX, right? So what that means is if this is greater than this, then this has to be the same amount greater than whatever the prediction is there. And that's going to be true of any linear method. Unless we add, so what logistic regression did that was different was to add this nonlinear squashing function. So once we did that, even though the linear part is still saying minus 5 here, we put it through that sigmoid, and now it becomes 0. Yeah. Great, yeah. Yeah. But this would mean that we're going to calculate the regression for being in a class and all the other classes, like to split phases always in two ways and calculate the W method, right? No, there's going to be, if I have 10 classes, I might be misunderstanding what you're saying. But if you have 10 classes, you have 10 W vectors. Is that?
Yeah, but how do you calculate each W vector?
How do I calculate each value? Okay.
No,
not really. So what you do is, let me see. So if I go here, right? So here I have the probability, let me see down here. Okay, so I had, what this equation says is if yi is 0, I use the W vector for 0. If yi is 1, I'd use the W vector for 1. If yi is 0, then I use the W vector for 0. I don't know if that makes sense. Maybe I'll write it, maybe if I write it a different way. Okay, so if I say, I can't even reach that, no. Okay, so if I say the data set, let's see, I have yi there. So I'll still say yixi. So what I have now is L of w is the sum I equals 1 through n. What if I put it this way? Is this going to make sense? Oh, it's not going to work. Yeah. So what we're going to do is we're going to take, where is it? The log of this thing. So it'll be log p y equals k given x, which is going to be, OK? So the log hits the x and go away. So it's going to be w, well, which k? So it'd be yi. So I could write it this way. Let me say y equals yi. That's the real. So given xi. Not doing this very well. So it'd be for each data item, it'll be the probability that y is the output I had in the data set given the input that I had in the data set. So this will be, so I'll take the weight vector that I have for yi. So it'd be w sub yi transpose xi. Now the log hits the fraction, becomes a minus. Minus log sum I equals 1. Did I say y? No, that should be a j. 1 through c exp w j transpose xi. So what I do is I take this function and I try to maximize it with respect to all of the wy, all the wk's. OK, I don't, did that answer your question, or is it still? Ah, so how do I actually choose these things? So what I do is I use one of the algorithms that I'm going to tell you about in the next set of slides. And what they do is they're basically some black boxes where if you give it a function L, a continuous function, and say, I want to maximize this with respect to its argument. And they go off and they think for a while. And they say, here's the W that maximizes this function. So there are kind of black boxes that you can use to do this. And I'm about to explain how those black boxes work. Yeah. Good. Is there anything else before I go on? Because it's going to be a bit different. So if there's something you don't understand so far, this is a good time. OK, so now let me go on to optimization. Okay, so for the rest of the class, I'm going to talk about numerical optimization algorithms. So a main idea in machine learning is that, let me move this down, is that I want to take this learning problem and convert it into an optimization problem. So I mean convert it into something where I have this function that takes a continuous vector, maps it to something else that's continuous, and I want to find the maximum value of that. When you can do this, that's a really powerful technique. I'll give some intuition as to why that is. So far, the examples that we've seen this happen in both linear regression and logistic regression, that I had this either classification or regression problem, and I converted it into an optimization problem. And in fact, we'll see some very important examples later this week, on Thursday, of SVMs and neural networks, which do the same thing. So maximum likelihood is a general way of making this move, where if I give you a probability distribution over all the data items, over all the, say, y's and x's, and then once I have this, this is now a continuous function of w, right? Because if the data is fixed and I want to optimize this with respect to w, I get some continuous function. And now I can say I want to maximize L of w with respect to w. So typically everything we're going to see in this course, if I start with a probabilistic method, it'll simplify things by assuming that the y's and x's are all independent. So that will convert this into this. I'll now have a product, and then the log hits it and becomes a sum. So we've seen that happen a couple of times in this course, both for linear regression and for logistic regression. So I have something where I have this function that I want to optimize, and it's a sum over all my training points of a function that only depends on that one training point. So what this, so I can look at it the other way. When I'm talking about optimization, it actually doesn't matter if I'm talking about minimization or maximization. Because if I want to maximize a function f, that's the same as minimizing minus f. So it really doesn't matter. So for the rest of this lecture, we'll say either way, I have a function e that I want to minimize. So for example, if I start it with if I start it with a likelihood here that I want to maximize, then I'll just set e to be minus l. Now I have a function I want to minimize. So we're going to do is we'll think graphically in weight space. So for example, if I had only one weight, so if I had a classifier with only one feature, then this error function is going to give me some kind of bowl here. And it seems like finding the minimum of this bowl, should be easy, right? You can just look at it and find the minimum. Or in calculus, you try to set the derivative to 0. But for the optimization algorithm, it's going to be a bit harder than that. I'll say a little bit more about that in a minute. But what we're looking for this algorithm to do is to have some information about this error surface, and then it'll be at some point, and it's going to try to descend this surface to find a point that has minimum error. Now, if we make no assumptions at all about the function that we're trying to minimize, then it's going to be impossible to do minimization. So, the reason is that I could have some crazy function that looks like this, where I'm trying to minimize this function e with respect to w. If I have something really crazy like this, the best I can do is to try to search through all possible values, right? There's no structure that I can use to do a better job of minimization. So the key constraint that we use is that, this function, but these functions that we're talking about in this class don't look like this. They're smooth in some sense. They have derivatives, and they're continuous. So if e is continuous, then we get a lot more help here. Because if I know the value of this function, and maybe I know its derivative, that gives me some information about a lot of nearby values of e. And I can use that information to try to do a better job of minimizing the function. So, and as we've said, it should not be surprising that the key tool we're going to use here is a derivative. Because to do all the analytic maximization that we've done so far, we've taken a derivative, set it to 0, and solved for w. So the reason why we care about derivatives is that they answer the question on the top bullet of the slide. That if I'm at a particular point in weight space, and I wiggle one weight, how much does that affect the error if I keep everything else the same? That's what the partial derivative with respect to wk really tells you. So what I can do is, if I choose my cost function to be differentiable, then I can use these partial derivatives. So the vector of all the partial derivatives is called the gradient. And I can either write it, typically I'll write it like this, although you can also write it like this. And the gradient is going to be a very powerful tool for doing minimization. Because the gradient points to the direction, tells me what the direction of steepest descent is going to be. So if I take a step in the gradient direction, so the gradient actually always points upwards. And the way you can remember that, because I always get mixed up about whether the gradient tells me steepest ascent or steepest descent. And the easiest way to remember that is to remember if f of x equals x squared, then df dx equals 2x. So if I'm here and I go in the direction 2x, I'm going up. It might not work for you, but that's my mnemonic aid. So what we're going to do, so this is why I said in the beginning, we want to convert a learning problem into a continuous optimization problem. Because now, once I'm in continuous space, if I'm in discrete space, so say I wanted to optimize over decision trees, right? If you remember from decision tree induction, I wanted to find a small tree that fits the data well. Well, there's no way to do global optimization there. If you remember, we had to do a greedy algorithm. Whereas if I can convert my my algorithm into continuous space, then I have derivatives. And derivatives let me do some more advanced optimization algorithms. So if I've decided that I want to be able to use this kind of continuous optimization, then there are three questions. You know, first, we have to choose our E in such a way that we can actually compute the gradient. So that's an issue of the design of the classification procedure. The second thing is, well, once we have the gradient, we need some algorithm that takes the gradient and the value and uses it to minimize the error. So I'll show you an example of such an algorithm on the next slide. And then once we've run the algorithm, we need to be able to show, do we actually end up at a minimum of weight space? And it turns out that will be a complex issue. So the general idea between a numerical optimization algorithm, as I've said, is there's some black box that, given an error function E, they try to minimize this with respect to W. Typically, they take two inputs. They'll take a procedure that you have to write that takes a W and computes E of W. So they'll need the value of the function you're trying to minimize. And also, you'll have to write a procedure that that computes the partial derivatives with respect to each of the weights. Now, you know, there's a large variety of numerical optimization algorithms. You know, lots of them depend on many different things. You know, there are some that use less information than this, and there's some that use more information than this. But the ones that that you typically care about, they require these two things. So now let's see an example of this. Oh, before I show you an example, I'm going to show you here's a kind of a cartoon of most optimization algorithms look like this. Most of them are iterative. So what they'll do is they'll start at some portion of weight space. So in every iteration of the algorithm, they'll be at some point like wi in weight space. And at that point, they can call those two procedures that you've given to get the error function and the gradient. So they'll have a sequence of iterates, a sequence of function values, and a sequence of gradients. And so if they're at point two, then they want to use this history to do something intelligent to get the next point. So typically what they'll do is you'll be in some loop like this. So as long as you seem to be kind of far from the minimum, what they'll do is they'll take your current point W, calculate the gradient, and then they'll choose a direction to go. And that direction is going to be some function of where you are, your current value, and the current gradient. And you know, maybe they'll use previous gradients as well. Depends on the algorithm. And then what they'll do is once they've chosen a direction D, they'll take a step in the direction of D. So they'll take my new value of W, say W2, will be W1 minus some scalar times this direction that I've chosen. And that'll be what it does at each iteration. Now the most natural, so now how am I going to choose D, right? That's the first issue I have to deal with. The simplest choice of D is just to use the gradient. And if you want to say, well, why should I be using the gradient? You know, the answer to that is Taylor's theorem. The intuitive way to look at this is if I take any the intuitive way to think about Taylor's theorem is that if I zoom in to any complex continuous function, if I zoom in close enough, it's going to look like a line. And so I can just say, well, if I pretend that this function really is a line, then I want to go in this direction to go down. And that's where the gradient comes from. But if you don't want to think of that, you can just say, well, I know, you can just take as given that the simplest choice for D is the gradient. If I substitute in the gradient, then I get this kind of very important and simple method for doing minimization, which is called gradient descent. And what it does, this thing should say E rather than L, although you could use it in either way. But gradient descent is a minimization algorithm. And what it does is, as long as my E is high enough, I take the gradient, and then I take a little step in the direction of the negative gradient. And I just keep going like that. So that's the whole algorithm. So it's very, very simple. And so you could, well, let me go a little bit. So now, there's still a parameter here that we have to choose. And that parameter is this scalar eta here, this Greek letter eta. This thing has to be greater than 0, or else I'm not descending the gradient anymore. And typically, it'll be some small number, like 0.1 or 0.01. But there's this trade-off between how I choose eta. So if I choose eta really small, what's going to happen is the algorithm's never going to go anywhere. And it'll take a million iterations to ever minimize the function. But if I choose eta too large, turns out the whole thing breaks. Doesn't do anything anymore. Just zooms off to infinity. So you need to choose some kind of intermediate value of eta. So that's why I call it the step size. So it says how big each of your gradient steps is going to be. Sometimes people also call it the learning rate. I don't really like that name, because if you have a learning rate, why don't you set it to maximum? You know, it doesn't make sense. That's why I prefer to call it the step size. So let's look at an example of running the gradient descent algorithm and the effect of the step size. So the thing I'm going to minimize here is just going to be w squared as a function of w. So I want to minimize this. The gradient of this is very easy. It's just 2w, right? So now I'm going to start at the function w equals 1. And so the function value is also 1. And I'm going to run gradient descent with eta equals 0.1. So each iteration is going to look like this. So what I do is I just take the previous value. I take the gradient, which is 2. So if I want to come up with compute w1, I'm at the point w0. So what I do is I compute the gradient of e at w0. So that's going to be 2 times w0, or 2. Multiply it by the step size. Now I get 0.2. Subtract it from w. So that gives me 0.8. That's good. That's closer to the minimum. And if I keep iterating this, now I'm going to do this again, but with w1 instead of w2. I'll get something that's a little bit closer, a little bit closer. And if I run it to 25 iterations, I'm getting pretty close to 0. So that's good. That's what I hoped it would do. So it looks like if I ran this for long enough, I actually would get to w equals 0, and that's the right minimum. So gradient descent has done the right thing in this case. But if I set eta really big, then it doesn't work anymore. So say I pick eta equals 1.1. Well, now what happens if I start at 1, I take my gradient step, and I'll go to minus 1.2. So what happens is I took such a big step that I leaped right over the minimum. And I'm actually farther from the minimum than I was before. And if I do that again, I'll go to 1.4, minus 1.7, and I'll keep doing this all the way to infinity. So I ran this 25 times, and I ended up at 80 when I started at 1. And that's typically what happens when you choose the step size too big. You know, or I could choose a really, really, really small step size. And then I think it's pretty obvious what's going to happen. I'll run it for 25 iterations, and I'll be at 0.988888 rather than being at 1.0. So this is kind of the trade-off that you're making when you're choosing the step size in gradient descent. So you might say, well, there's got to be some kind of automatic method for choosing the step size. You know, there are. None of them are really so great. But here's a simple one that you could use if you need it. The simplest way you can do it is you can look at, what you do is after each gradient step, you look at whether the function actually went down or not. So what you do, what this thing here is, I don't know if this is the official name, but we call it bold, you could call it bold driver, just a heuristic for choosing eta. And so what you do is you say, well, I'm going to take a gradient step. That's what I do here. And then what I do is I look at my new error, and I look at my old error. So e is going to be my old error. If I went up, if the error actually went up when I took a gradient step, that's bad. So I'm going to say, let me back off. I'll make the step a little bit smaller. Whereas if I went, if it actually got better, if this new e is actually less than my old e, then I'm going to make the step size a little bit bigger, maybe 0.01, right? And then I, notice what if I, and then I replace my w and my g with this new one that I've computed. So if I get better, so if my error gets better, I accept the step. I accept my step w1, and I go for a bigger step size next time. Where if it gets worse, I throw away this new point and go for a smaller step size. You know, this doesn't, you know, sometimes you need to tune, you know, this number or this number. But, you know, but it can be a good heuristic. So I guess I think the reason why it's called bold driver is it kind of gets, because the eta is going to go up exponentially with a very small exponent as it keeps getting, as long as, you know, the objective function keeps going down. So what this does, it gets faster, 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 crash. And I guess that's why I call it bold driver. So I don't recommend actually driving that way. Okay, so that's gradient descent. So there are a couple other enhancements you can make to gradient descent. The most important one is whether you want to do batch gradient descent or online gradient descent. So as we've seen, all of the objective functions so far that we've tried to minimize have this kind of additive form where my whole objective function depends on a lot of mini errors that only depend on one of my training examples. Okay, so for example, in logistic regression, this kind of EI that depends on only one training example is just my log probability. Now, so the algorithm that we've seen so far for gradient descent, well, what is it going to do? What it's going to do is it's going to decide which direction to go. It's going to compute the gradient. So to compute the gradient, it's going to sum over all my training examples and compute the derivative of this log probability on that example. Well, and then once it's got that, it's got the gradient, and it'll change the parameters. It'll take a step in that direction. Well, that seems reasonable, but if n is a million, then this isn't so hot, right? Because I can't make any change at all to my parameters until I've swept through all million of these training examples. I guess a million isn't so big anymore, but you know, a billion, whatever. There are training sets that are very, very large. And that doesn't seem so great because, you know, if I have a million training examples and I pick 1,000 of them randomly, that probably gives me a pretty good idea about what the real gradient is. So I probably should be able to make some kind of change to the parameters after having seen only a few examples. Or maybe after having only seen just one example. And that's the idea behind online gradient descent. And I think what I, so what online gradient descent does, so in batch gradient descent, what I did is at each iteration, I go through the entire training set, compute the derivative of the error on that training set, and then take a gradient step. What online gradient descent does, on the other hand, so this is something very similar, but instead of summing over the entire training set here, I'll just pick one example. So what I could do is I could say I'll pick a uniform random integer between 1 and n. That'll be my j. And then I compute the gradient only of that example. And then once I've got that g, I take a gradient step. So that's called, sometimes that's called stochastic gradient descent, because I picked the training instance stochastically that I was going to compute the gradient of. You know, there are other ways. You can imagine lots of other ways of picking j, you know, but this is one common way of doing it. So the main difference between doing batch and online, there are advantages and disadvantages of both. The biggest advantage for online is if I have a huge data set, or if I have a data set like maybe computational advertising, where I'm continually getting a stream of new examples, then doing online makes a lot of sense. The advantage of doing a batch method is that gradient descent is really the simplest possible optimization method. There are lots of complex optimization methods that we're not going to go through in this course, but that can work a lot better than gradient descent. And if I want to use those, I pretty much have to be in the batch setting. They don't really work so well in the online setting. So next time what I'll do is I'll finish up, go through the problems with gradient descent, and then I'll talk about SVMs. See you Thursday. Hello.
Understood that part of gradient descent isn't just to find the minima of E, is it? Is
that the point? That's the point.
Just differentiate it, because then you'll have and set it to zero. Can you not just
you can, but you can't always find the solution.
Oh, I see. Obviously,
So even like logistic regression, there's no closed form solution for the W.
Okay, I see. Thank you.
Sure.
Does the gradient descent only find the first minimum and then the difference?
We're going to talk about that. So the question is, what does first minimum mean?
I mean, you start somewhere, and if the function is like that, it will find this one and stop here.
Yeah, it just finds, it'll only find one of the minima and not necessarily the best one, right? So we call that if you have, it'll converge to a local minimum, but obviously that might not be global. And if you have a function that has many local minima, it turns out there's really no good answer. Whoops, I thought I muted that.
Maybe I should actually write that down. Oh, I see. That's probably a mistake. That should be J. Yeah. Thanks. Why don't you? If I have a linear regression, right, like this, so if it's predicting one here and zero here, it'll predict like minus one, minus two, maybe it's predicting minus five out of it, right? So now it's going to look at those, and this is squared error, right? So these points, I'm told the target is zero, and I'm predicting minus five. So that's a huge contribution to the squared error, right? It's going to dominate. So it's going to try to tilt this to make this closer to zero, even though it's already minus five. I think we're aiming for 3 weeks at this point. Let me actually just look at it. I think we are aiming for 3 weeks. Right, because it's due the 22nd, right? It's due here. So we're aiming to have it in basically a week's time. So maybe 30 days. There's going to be an announcement about that, and I haven't decided about this particular project. But I'm not sure exactly. It's going to have to be soon. But I haven't decided on what the timetable is going to be for that project. For the other, you should definitely apply by December 16th to the main university website, and then this thing will be something. But this thing will be something different. And once I decide how the process is going to be. I don't have a lot about this on my website, but when I send out the announcement, it'll say something about that.